to the Beef Watch Podcast. I'm Aaron Berger, a Nebraska Extension educator. For today's Beef Watch Podcast, we're going to go back and revisit a conversation we actually had back in March of 2023. At that time, I had the opportunity to interview Dr. Garland Dahlke, who's a research scientist at Iowa State University, as well as David Breeny, who's the beef teaching herd superintendent there at Iowa State. We had a conversation about a research project they've been involved with there, and the title of that podcast was Swath Grazing Forage Sorghum and Pearl Millet as a Winter Feed Option for Cows in Iowa. And so I'd encourage you, if you're listening to this podcast today, go back and listen to that podcast. They go into a lot of depth around the history of that project, what they've learned. But I wanted to come back and have a conversation with them again. They've just completed their fifth year of this transition from cows in a dry lot to grazing some cows out on swaths, and I wanted them to give us an update. So David and Garland, let's go ahead and dive in. Tell us about where you're at with the project right now and some of the things you're learning.
I'll start out, and then I'll let David fill in the blanks because he can give you a lot of color and details on it. You know, a few years ago, we got into this. Both David and I got interested kind of independently, but luckily we crossed paths and we've been doing it together ever since. But, you know, originally it was kind of a labor saver because there's kind of a feudal cycle of driving tractors around and around and around, hauling feed, hauling manure, hauling feed, hauling manure. And, you know, you really just can't spend that much time with your cows, even though they're nice. You may like them and stuff. There's just too many other things that got to be done. And it is a low margin business. You kind of got to watch where you invest. So, I mean, that's kind of partly what got us started. We tried it. It worked out well. It's been going good ever since. And I say, as we've been doing it, we've been trying different things. David mentioned one year, he says, you know, we got all these cows outside all winter now, and we're right next to the city of Ames, and there's a lot of people that are pretty concerned about what we're doing. And we're dealing with a population that's, they know their dogs and cats, but they really aren't into, you know, livestock as we know it. You know, these are outdoor animals, but are we abusing them? You know, what happens if we get pinched or something? Can we prove it? So we had a little project where we split the herd in half. We had four groups of cows on campus. We had a big group of cows at the McNay Research Farm. We split them. So halves and halves, were some in the dry lot with a roof over their heads and round bales and bedding. And we had some that were out on the swaths all winter. And I said, we took the time to measure how these cows really do. And we looked at feed intake. We looked at body condition, you know, weight and all that. But as far as body condition goes, we used ultrasound. We didn't want to just guesstimate, because they say when cows are clean and fluffy, they look like they're in good shape, but they calve and then they may not look so good. So I thought, well, let's use the ultrasound machine. Let's get some real numbers here that we have, you know, a basis for what we're doing. And so we did. So we took that all into account. We also got into looking at, you know, it's not just a cow thing. It's also about the guy taking care of them. You know, how much time and effort are we putting into these different groups? So we kept track of all those man hours of doing chores on both sides of the thing here. We looked at tractor hours, how many hours in the tractor we're spending, you know, because in the dry lot, you got to start up a tractor every day. Out in the swaths, we didn't start up a tractor all winter. So that all came into it. And I say that's kind of what we looked at kind of pretty closely here. Illinois Beef gave us a grant to even do this and share the data with them. So we did. And that's kind of the background of what we did and looked at here. I'll let David fill in the blanks now on everything else.
Yeah. So thanks for having us on. So I think Garland did a really great job there covering kind of the backstory and where we're at on it. I'm not going to go into too much detail on the production cycle and how we manage that to get these couple of crops in one year in here. I think we covered that quite lengthy detail, Aaron, and the first time we visited about this. But really, I think what we've learned, a couple things quick here out of the gate that I think we've learned after 5 years doing this, is that A, it works. B, the labor savings on this, it's a real deal. Like Garland was talking about, I can tell you that just from doing it for 5 years and then having to be the one to go in and tell your crew that we're going to put a bunch of cows back in a dry lot for the winter. I mean, you want to see a cowboy crew get pretty upset. That's a way to do it. The other thing that I think is really important to note in this is that the genetic differences that we've identified in some of these cows while doing this, but yet also tweaking it for the quality of feed. I think being able to monitor that quality of feed and really getting a handle on that is one of the things that would be a big difference for somebody in this. Monitoring what that feed is, because it's going to change, and it's going to change throughout the year, probably not as linearly as you would think, based solely on the difference in weather conditions that you have. We talked earlier about it being a really nice open winter. I had a lot of people talk to me about, well, this must be so great for swath grazing. Actually, the contrary. It's bad for swath grazing because my feed's leaching faster in these freeze-thaw cycles. But the catch to that is that the cow's energy requirement is quite a bit lower, and we had some really good feed while we were doing this as well. Wouldn't you think, darling?
Yeah, I think you're correct, David. Yeah, like I say, it's really ideal when you can just cut it and freeze it, just like you put vegetables in the freezer and just leave it there till the cows eat them. And like this last winter, it was mild. And so, I mean, we didn't have frost in the ground most of the winter here. It was, which is different than what we're used to. It is a little different that way. So, and the, I guess the other thing is, you know, really that moisture in the air when it's exposed, that it's hard on the forage quality. It's just like hay in the summertime if it gets rained on, as I've mentioned that before. And if you can keep the moisture off of it, you're going to be in good shape. But like I say, it was an easy winter for the cows. And so if anything we lost there, I think we made up for it with the ease of the climate this past winter. So it wasn't a big deal in that regard.
I also think, Aaron, the other thing that needs to be noted here, and I think we talked about it the first time we visited, is that with the type of forage that we've got, you really need to make sure these cows are in adequate body condition going in. This feed, as we've been doing it the last 5 years, is really great at maintaining body condition on cows. You're definitely not going to bump them up a half to three quarters of a body condition, though, doing this, unless you're willing to undergo some fairly heavy supplementation while you're out here.
So I do want to touch on that a little bit, because as we were talking before we got on, you did have some significant deterioration in quality this year. Did you have to do some supplementation to complement then the forage that you ended up with?
Yeah, so that's a great question, Aaron. So yes, this year we did supplement. Kind of the beautiful part about this is that as those cows, if a producer's ultrasounding and kind of keeping an eye on what stage of gestation those cows are going into, it works really good just to sort those, you know, as they tip over into that point where they're going to need to be supplemented. In how we calve early on in the calving window, it works really good that those cows are just removed. And then the cows that do not need supplementation are the ones that will remain out there. That's the group that you heard me reference at the beginning of the episode, of that we had a group of cows last year that we grazed 365 days with no stored feed, just because that's just kind of the way it worked out for us. Those cows did get a protein supplement. When I say we didn't feed any stored feed, I mean, we weren't hauling silage and round bales to them and those types of things. This year, we elected to go with a lick tub, mainly just for an ease of protein delivery with the student crew that I had and what we had available for equipment at the time. The protein supplementation and the energy is just kind of what we're going to keep an eye on, making sure that you have those forage tested, and kind of keep an eye on it as it goes through the winter is hugely important. And the last part of that is understanding different crops are going to leach out faster than others. Referencing a pearl mill, it's not going to lose nearly as much feed value as a sorghum crop, but the pearl millet probably didn't start out at as high a feed value either. So knowing those individual crops and the time of year you need to be utilizing them is really going to help to somebody's success on this.
So David, then you're taking samples through the winter, if I understand correctly, to kind of know where you're at, or how are you gauging the quality of what's actually going into the mouth of the cow?
Yep. So we've taken a lot of samples throughout the year. Mainly, I say we, like I was the one out there. Garland is the one who's had to take the brunt of the sampling process, and I couldn't have done any of this without him. We do monitor that feed value. We will take it at the beginning of the year or the right after we swath now, and we will still do some spot sampling. But for the most part, we've done enough measuring of this that unless we're changing varieties or something like that, I'm pretty confident that we know about how that feed's going to deteriorate.
You mentioned supplementation and you went with a lick tub this year to do that. I guess you guys are in the heart of ethanol production as well. Any Yep. use of distiller's grains to try to complement this, or how would you maybe try to incorporate that?
Yeah, so early on, we did use some ethanol byproducts for supplementation, wet or dry. Garland does my nutrition work. Garland can tell you we'll do whatever's cheap and whatever we have the availability and infrastructure to get out there efficiently without adding a whole bunch of more steps. We've used some modified distillers. We've used some gluten products in the past. I think it's a great option that you can use. Pretty much my advice would be whatever's cheap and whatever fills the void, go for it. And that you're not going to have to take a whole bunch of extra time going out there. If you're going to start a feed wagon, go out and supplement protein, we're kind of defeating a little bit of what we're doing here.
Yeah, that's right. And I guess that's why, you know, David went with the lick tubs, just to prove that that works too. And a lot of it is how much energy you need. A lick tub only is so much, you know. I guess it's give them a little protein boost and away they went. And that was adequate this year. And I guess the thing is, you know, when those cows get about a month from calving, you kind of got to change your tune and make sure that they're getting a pretty good diet so everything works okay. I'd say 3 to 4 weeks before you expect them to start having a baby on the ground. So I say there is where you really want to start supplementing it when it's needed. And really our supplementing, like when we did use the byproducts, it's pretty much just top dress the swaths, and they all know what to do from there. They clean it all up pretty good. And it's pretty easy, you know. And I guess if it's wet and muddy, you know, that's one thing. But it really, it's been pretty, it could have been muddy, but it really hasn't been. I say we have a pretty good sod base. When you grow a crop like sorghum sedan grass or pearl millet, and, you know, as long as you're not spending too much time, you can drive right over the top and deliver that feed. And it doesn't seem to be too much of an issue. And I guess that's part of it too, is we do get a pretty good sod base there that holds you up, that you can get out there. And as long as you don't monkey around, and as long as you don't let the cows stand in one place too long, you know, the mud issue really isn't bad. Otherwise it would be. And so that's just something to be aware of, I guess, when you are doing this.
Yeah. So Aaron, we're talking about mud. I'm guessing anybody listening to this who's ever grazed cows on stock knows what I'm talking about when we talk about mud. And that is 100% what I anticipated 5 years ago when we started this. But the amount of root structure that is underneath that sorghum crop is so wildly, and even the pearl millet, wildly phenomenal that you could have the same set of cows standing in a stock field, you know, on 30-inch rows, and it'll just look like a disaster. Not that the guy's doing a bad job operating. It's just that we've got 30 inches of exposed ground there without that really fibrous root structure like we have here. We have not seen that in these swaths. We had a hickey once or twice where, you know, some cows piled up in a corner in a snowstorm or something. And in the spring, you might have been able to see a little bit of a scar there, but it's nothing like a bunch of cows piling up on corn stalks. And which to me still just blows my mind, Aaron, that this stuff's this neat.
Yeah. And I was just going to circle back. You know, you mentioned these cows out on these swaths. They're staying out there with weather. You're not necessarily bringing them in. I guess, how are you handling weather? Because as I think about where you guys are, it's not like you got tree rows and a lot of topography change there. You're fairly flat.
Yeah, no, we're definitely catching your wind as it blows all the way across. It's probably the same wind hitting us. But we have offered windbreaks for these cows. I think Garland probably has the same smile as I do. Every time, this year in January is no exception, we get into one of these really cold, bitterly cold blowing deals, those cows might go behind a windbreak for a little bit of time, But you can drive by the cows out on swaths in a raging blizzard, and they will be head down in those swaths grazing. They, like I said, they might bunch up for a 2 or 3 hours, maybe in a real bad spot. But all your other cattle on the entire farm or ranch will be still holed up, and these cows out on swaths are just out there going to town on these swaths. And when you first see it, it kind of makes you stop for a minute because you're thinking, what is going on here? But it happens every single year, and I think Garland can touch on that a little bit, that we may have stumbled into something on that.
Yeah, I guess, you know, one of the things we did in this, the project that you referenced, Aaron, where we're looking at the sheltered versus the swath cows, you know, we measured all sorts of things, but we also just did, you know, mud scores. And we started the project, everybody came off corn stalks and stuff, and they were all clean, you know, mud score one, nothing on them, you know. And by the end of the year, the cows that were on swaths were still a one, without exception. They were all still black and fuzzy. Those that we had in the confinement or the lots, you know, they were big lots, and we used a lot of bedding, 600 pounds, over 600 pounds of corn stalks per cow it ended up being. They had a, you know, a condition or mud condition score about 2.5. And, you know, it's a 1.5 number, you know, difference, but it's about, oh, I don't know, maybe 30 degrees difference in lower critical temperature. And so those cows that are clean and fluffy, they really handle the cold very well. And, you know, keeping them clean is a big part of that, because they say their hair coat is nice and fluffy yet, and it's really a big deal as far as having them weather the storms without any issues. And I kind of mentioned earlier when I was just visiting before our podcast, Aaron, you know, those cows stay a lot cleaner, I say, then when they have a calf in March or April or whenever you calve, you know, those little calves, the first thing that gets in their mouth when they try to nurse is milk rather than manure. Because if you have a dirty cow and they're trying to find the udder and find their first meal, you know, they get a mouthful of manure, and it's no wonder people struggle with scours, where that's one thing we haven't had on all our swath cows is scour issues. We haven't. Those calves have always been up and running and pretty much like little deer at the beginning. The biggest challenge is to get a tag in their ear, because they are out running around like that. So I said that's been a, I think that's a big deal. And I think it's something that people really need to consider. And I suppose it's similar to your Sandhills calving kind of plan, in a sense, keeping the cow clean, that the calf doesn't get contaminated right away.
David, you mentioned your crew and just the transition that's happened for them mentally. I think I'd like to just go into that a little bit, because I think as we talk about making changes like this, there sometimes is a mental model you come with. And I shared this in the last podcast we did, but my mental model was that you really could not swath graze in Iowa. It was just too wet. That would be a wreck. And you guys saw that you could do that by delaying harvest till basically Christmas time, first of the year. So you got a standing crop, and then you put it in the windrow to increase harvest efficiency. And so you figured out a way to get past that paradigm. I guess just talk about the paradigm shift that's happened with your crew about, hey, we don't need to start a tractor to feed a cow.
Yeah. So I think that's a lot bigger deal. And I'm glad that you touched on it, Aaron, than most people probably take into account, because it almost feels kind of sacrilegious here for a little bit when you start down that. The biggest thing that I would say has been a challenge from a crew, and keep in mind, these are all undergraduate students as well, to add another level of complexity into this, is that you really have to be good with your fencing and your water infrastructure on this. And I don't mean that we need these huge, elaborate six strand fences, but we do have to have enough adequate electric fence coverage to get those cows contained. They won't test that fence very much. The other thing that we've learned with, you talk about a paradigm shift with the students, nobody ever thinks about the snow drifting in against a woven wire fence out in the middle of an 80 in the middle of the winter. Well, if you're grazing swaths and you have one of these blizzards blow in, and especially a crusty one, you need to go out there. That may be the only time, and we had it happen this winter, where we will take a tractor and break that so that the cows can't walk over a perimeter fence in the event that we get a blizzard and they start walking with wind or something. So there's just a couple of things that most producers in our part of the world, Aaron, probably don't think of that you need to start being a little cognizant of. But compared to a labor thing, you have a lot more time to do those things in the middle of the winter that we all talk about doing that we never get to do. So we're a lot more efficient with our labor. We have actually decreased quite a bit of labor out of the operation in the last 5 years due to changing how we feed these cows in the winter. And they don't hate coming to work every day.
Well, I want to touch on also just your feed use efficiency, because I think for some folks are thinking, yeah, you're swath grazing, but think about all the waste you have. I guess just share with us over the last 5 years what you've learned there in terms of what was there in the field versus what actually got into the belly of the cow.
Yeah, I'll start on this. Yeah, I was going to say Garland has those numbers. I'll let Garland touch on this and then I'll finish it up. How about that?
Okay, yeah, that'll be good. So we did measure that stuff. It's kind of interesting. So I guess just total feed usage, you know, when we measured how much hay we burned through, and, you know, and as I say, when we start it, we take yield estimates of our swaths and our fields and what we have out there. And we burned through about 28 pounds of dry matter per cow per day on the swaths. In the yard, where we fed round bales and the round bale feeders, we were at 26.7, and that's total hay, and that's not counting any straw or corn stalks we use for bedding, because the cows did eat some of that as well. So I guess that's part of it. So I mean, it's pretty close up front in that regard. I guess the next thing is what makes the swaths versus just maybe some stockpile grazing, what sets that apart is the utilization difference is so much better with the swaths. And, you know, throughout the year, we were measuring all that too. And our utilization in December was about 90% of those swaths being cleaned up. And I mean, you get a few sticks and twigs left behind, but really 90% of that feed was consumed that was in a swath out there. And that's a big deal. As winter progresses, you know, some of that freezes down, the cows can't get it, but when it would thaw out, because we do get a lot of freeze thaw weather, a lot of times the cows would go back and repick through it, and they clean up quite a bit of extra stuff, which that was kind of a nice bonus. But, you know, as we got into March, you know, there we get a lot of rain, and the freeze and thaw, of course, is always going on. There, you know, the utilization isn't quite so good. And I say we had enough feed that we could go through March. And there, March, you're getting about 50% utilization, which that's not that great. But in December and January, we're getting 90%. So that really makes a pretty big difference there. And so you really don't burn through a lot of feed that way, as you may anticipate that happening. And I say with the round bale feeders, we tried to be kind of careful as far as putting not too much out, and they always waste some there. And if we fed in a bunk, I suppose it'd be a little bit better, but there too, it starts getting to be, you know, you got to have a hay grinder and all these other things going on. So we tried to keep labor as minimal as possible, just to kind of go dollar per dollar, hour per hour, you know, what's going on there. So I say that's worked out really well.
Well, and I think the other part of this is somebody might look at this, Aaron, from the outside and say, well, why didn't you just bale that feed up and go and feed it? When you look at the from the windrow till consumption on that feed, most people only like to measure their loss as to what that bale feeder is, right? We never talk about storage loss. Nobody ever seems to talk about the loss at baling in the field, shatter out. You know, I've never seen a baler yet that's 100% efficient. We eliminate all that with no transportation, no manure hauling at the end. I mean, I care deeply about our making sure we're being good stewards with our nutrients and that, but just at a very simple level, that's all labor that has to be assessed back to this operation that we're saving every time that cow grazes that feed right where it was grown, and we don't have to haul manure. We no-till drill a cool season crop. We actually have already done it this year. Right behind these swaths, there is no field prep behind these cows at all after this is done.
Yeah, touch on that a little bit, because I think some folks might be thinking, well, you just said you had 50% waste in the field. Can you get a drill through that? Are you bunching up in front of your drill? What's that look like?
Well, part of that waste is the feed's already kind of compost, and that's the stuff the cows don't eat. But when you measure, you know, utilization, you got to pull that junk up and weigh it and see it all. So I say that stuff is pretty well on its way of being gone in March. And so when April comes around and we want to do some field work or put something in the ground, it's pretty much eliminated. It's gone. And it's really just that end of the season stuff that gets bad like that. You know, the stuff in December, January, most of February, it's pretty well cleaned up really well. And so that's a big advantage in that regard. I mean, so that you don't have residue out there as you would anticipate.
Yeah, the drilling, we haven't run into any issues as far as no-tilling. We had one spot that we took a tedder out and we knocked some, it was a variety that really didn't work and we didn't hit it at the right time. Knocked it apart with a tedder and we drilled into it. That was last spring. Other than that, that is the only field prep we've ever done. And when I'm talking about that, this was like an acre and a half that we did that to. Other than that, your field prep is opening the gates and setting the drill and going. We're using a John Deere drill. It's just what we've got. I really have come to appreciate the slit and place seed placement on those, just because our depth of our seeding is so crucial when we're putting these warm seasons in following the cool season crop that we start the year off on this project with.
So talk about that a little bit, David. You're planning, I'm not sure what your spring crop is this year, but sometimes you've had oats, putting in a spring crop and then harvesting that for hay, and then you come with your summer crop. Is that correct?
Yep. So we've done oats. We've had rye in front of it, kind of depending on what that land use was. Usually the rye will be if we're going into a new area to do it in. Last year we did peas and oats, as well as some straight peas. We actually chopped that, and it's one of our main feeds that we feed to calves at weaning time. Garland's on here, does all my nutrition work. I can't hide anything. Garland sees all my feed samples. We can produce a lot of ultra high quality feed to really give this operation some pretty unique marketing opportunities through just a large quantity of high quality feed for not a lot of money when we're cranking two, in a good year, three crops off 1 year, 1 acre in the same year. I don't know if Garland, if you want to touch on the pea oat silage a little bit.
Yeah, it's been a very good crop. We're getting some nitrogen put in the ground, you know, with the peas, which is a nice thing as well. It's very high quality, you know, as growing up in Wisconsin for our dairy cows and alfalfa would freeze out, peas and oats or peas and triticale was kind of a emergency crop that you could use and you would never miss a beat with milk production with a milk cow. For these young calves, it works out very well too. And, you know, it gives you really a nice backgrounding diet. You've got, it's high quality feed. The calves like it. And you just let them go. And it's really quite nice. And I say then, and it's an early crop. You know, as soon as it starts getting warm, peas really don't like it so much. So I said, then it's time to put in our sorghum sedan grass or our pearl millet, just kind of hit the ground running. I guess as another thing for all the crop farmers out there, you know, this really helps, gives you another, I guess, tool against rootworms and cyst nematodes. As I say, when you start putting sorghum in, that really helps knock that problem down. Do it for a couple years in a row, and I think you'd see a nice result in terms of pest control. I say this, and I say it's something you can do for a year or do it for 2 years, whatever. and it's not a big deal. It's not like you're tied into a permanent pasture crop or a perennial, that's gonna you want to get a few years out. This is a 1 year thing, or maybe 2 years if you want to, but it really works nice that way.
David, one of the things you said before we start our conversation is that you had a group of cows you actually grazed out for 365 days. Now they were on the harvested swaths and some supplement, and then you had to actually feed some cows for about 60 days this year and felt like, ah, that's more than I want to. I guess just to take that conversation a little further, because I think for a lot of folks, if they could only feed for 60 days, that would be pretty delightful in many people's minds.
Yeah, I always when I'm at producer meetings or I'm speaking to people, I always kind of feel a little bit guilty when I'm complaining about having to feed cows. I try to only have to feed cows for 60 to 90 days. Like I said earlier, would be a wreck anymore for our operation. We try and graze those cows on swaths, and then we sort those cows up according to our ultrasound groups. And then we will start pulling those cows. We had our last set of cows to calve, kind of the late calvers. We did graze those 365 days, and those cows went right off the swaths that were left and that little bit of supplement, and they started right into the pasture rotation right after, turnout shots on everybody. And I usually have an insurance policy of feed standing around. I'm trying to make sure now that that insurance policy of feed is a marketable insurance policy. Pretty easy to market large round bales of forage. It's pretty tough to market a bunker of silage other than putting it on four legs and having it get off a truck. So we're kind of shifting maybe how we look at that insurance policy or that forage insurance policy, so that if we get through most of the winter and we've grazed all but 35 to 40 days, if we have to feed 35 to 40 days, we can just sell the excess feed or sit on it as a little bit of a drought buffer. But we don't make near the forage on this operation that we used to, and we graze a lot more of our perennial hay fields as pasture now than we even did probably 5 years ago.
Yeah, touch on that a little bit. So some of your perennial hay fields you were putting up, I assume, like a brome alfalfa type mix or a brome clover mix, but now you're grazing some of those.
Yep. So as we have transitioned those fields out, I have really liked some of the This is a trade name variety, but like the STF 43 fescues do so well in our area. We don't have the endophyte issues with them. The way we manage our summer rotational grazing system, we don't run into much for fescue problems. It's allowed us to not have to put up so much hay because we don't need it. We can do a lot better. We have more avenues. Like we have a buyback heifer program now where we're developing and marketing bred heifers for our students here. Now they do that. We didn't have that type of flexibility before because we needed all these acres of perennial hay ground to put up hay for these cows. Whereas now we can use a different class of cattle, like some developing heifers, to utilize that feed. And then if we do get dry, we've got some flexibility in the grazing system that we can utilize. We can get rid of those cattle if we need to. We just have a lot more flexibility here, and I guess is the best way to put it, really.
What are some other take homes? I guess, again, you've been at it 5 years, and obviously, as we talk about it, I don't hear either of you saying you're going to go back. As we work towards summarizing, what are just kind of some key take homes from your experience? Some things maybe also you're looking at as opportunities now that you're committed to this system.
Well, I guess I'll do mine first and I'll let Garland wrap it up here. My take homes in this are know your forage quality is probably the biggest one if you're looking at swath grazing. The other one is do not try and think that you're only going to feed for 30 days out of the year. We didn't start off in that place. We started with a goal of decreasing 30 days worth of feeding out of, 180 to 170 day annual feeding regimen in the winter. That's important. This is a journey, not a destination, I think, because there's a lot of moving parts. You've really got to learn how to gauge Mother Nature on this, but keeping track of that feed quality and matching it to your cow's plane of nutrition, where she's at in her production cycle is so important. And then think about the flexibility of your operation would be my big takeaways on that, and keep those cows clean in the winter. and I'll let Garland wrap it up.
Yeah, that's pretty well sums up things. It's pretty basic. You know, the thing is, you just kind of got to think ahead a little bit, and it's not anything that most grazers aren't already doing, because most people that are serious about grazing, they plan, and that's kind of what you're doing here. You're just thinking, okay, what cropland do I need to do something with? Where do I have a pest like a rootworm problem or cyst nematodes that I want to take care of, you know? And I think do it that way and keep things kind of simple, and you know, try a little bit. You know, I guess that's the thing, just try a little bit. You'll figure things out pretty quick on what works for you, what doesn't. I guess the next thing is just keep your eyes open for good plant species to try and use. You know, we say sorghum or sorghum sedan grass. Well, they're not all created the same. And so I guess don't be afraid to try some different species, just like you would be with different hybrids of corn. I say that just dive in and go. That's just kind of how it is with this project.
Well, Garland, David, I really appreciate your time today. I always enjoy visiting with you because I appreciate your taking a research approach to an issue that I think increasingly we need to figure out is how do we reduce harvested feed costs? How do we reduce labor and equipment? And I just really appreciate the project. And also for you, I think shattering some paradigms that at least for sure I had, that you really couldn't do this in your part of the world. And you've shown that you can, and you can make it work, and not just 1 year, but over several years. So again, appreciate the research project, appreciate the data, and thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Aaron.
Not a problem.
For more information on this project, you can find Dr. Garland Dahlke's contact information. He's at the Iowa Beef Center there at Iowa State University, as well as David Breeny. His information is there as well. There's a lot of good presentations in addition to the Beef Watch podcast that they put together. Those can be found on the web. And so would encourage you to check those out.